Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the other September 11th, film screening and discussion about the lasting impacts of the U.S.-funded military coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. The event will take place on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. This film screening will include two 30-minute documentaries that focus on Mapuche land reclamation and language revitalization, as well as a discussion with the filmmaker about the specific laws that have been used to target the indigenous Mapuche people since the dictatorship began in 1973. Again, that's the other September 11th, on Friday, September 11th, at 7 p.m. at Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with gypsy, Celtic, and Americana influences. The show was originally scheduled for Revolution Hall, and all tickets for that show will be honored. Again, that's Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th, 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Let the fires burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Michelle Ross. She's a professor and the head of the Department of Drawing and Painting at the Oregon College of Art and Craft. And she's here to talk about her show, Trust Falls and Transparent Things, at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery from September the 3rd through September the 26th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Michelle.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This show is—you described it as a return to a painting show, a pure painting show, because you've experimented with photography and other media within painting before. So you're use a lot of different media on this. Things I'd never heard of, flash, for example. So these are abstract paintings that use things like plaster, chalk, you're using beach, different papers. And the viewer should know these are sort of medium-sized paintings, most of them, as big as you could hold in your arms. A lot of pastel type colors, a lot of geometric shapes like parallelograms and irregular polygons. And they're just very abstract. You kind of lose yourself in the forms. So just tell us, what were you thinking when you put this show together this summer?
Going off of this idea of Trust Falls, the title actually came to me after I made the decision to work on a purely painting show. The concept of Trust Falls was something I grew up with as a kid in the 70s. The idea of not knowing exactly what's behind you and falling into it anyway.
Hang on, how did that play out as a child? Were your parents making you?
Well, in the 70s, there was a lots of consciousness raising and group activities. And I was raised Unitarian, and there was just a lot of community sorts of activities where we play things like that. It's funny, if you look it up, Trust Falls, it comes up as an activity that corporations use for team building, which I thought was kind of funny. And I thought, well, I'm going to build this fantastic team of paintings. That occurred to me. And then Transparent Things is actually the name of a novella by Vladimir Nabokov. I was reading that book too for pleasure, but I realized within the first couple pages that he essentially sets out a fantastic metaphor for painting within the first pages, where he talks about staying in the now, staying on the surface, and the dangers of falling too deeply into an object because you'll become trapped in nostalgia.
Is he literally talking about painting?
No, he's not literally talking about painting, but he's talking about staying in the now. And to me, that translates into this idea of the surface of the painting, a topography that you have to stay engaged with as you're making, as I'm making the paintings, but also as a viewer. What I hope is that you really can stay engaged with the surface while you may be pulled into the space or the color. There's hopefully an awareness of all the decisions that are made sort of on that surface.
Mm-hmm. So this flash stuff is highly matte.
Correct. It's I use it sort of as a foil for what might be an oilier sort of a shinier quality to the oil paint. But the paintings themselves tend to be fairly, not shiny, I mean, fairly flat and matte. Partly that goes back to my influence from fresco painting when I spent some time in Italy over a decade ago. That sort of quality of matteness that the colors are being sort of absorbed into the surface. And so the flash kind of gives me that quality. Also the plaster that I'm applying to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Where were you looking at frescoes?
In Rome. And I've been just fascinated with how the image is integrated into the architecture. But then that quality of that surface being not shiny and flashy and spectacular like many contemporary kinds of surfaces.
Mm-hmm. Right. You mean in real life and in the art school?
Yeah. That sort of fascination with the shiny surface of the screen and contemporary materials like plastics. I mean, even oil paint can be that way. But maybe it's just an aesthetic choice, but I do think that it has this relationship to keeping the viewer and keeping myself aware of what's happening just in that immediate presence of the surface of the painting.
Mm-hmm. The shapes you're choosing, I don't know what you call them. They're not rhombuses or parallelograms. Some of them are triangles. Mm-hmm. There's usually two or three of them, sometimes two, dominating part of the picture. So this one, as invisible as possible, unfolds in a twinkle. What are these things?
Well, I don't name them. I'm interested in geometry from a mathematical or theoretical point of view, but I don't know enough about it to employ it as subject. What I'm really doing is finding a way into the space of the painting, and honestly, diagonals offer that opportunity. It's a way to divide space, you know. You're limited within the confines of this rectangle or this near square. It's really thinking about dividing the space. And in this case, and in the series that sort of started the whole body off, this idea of an above and a below, dividing the format in half exactly, and then creating a shape that was five or six sides that did not mirror each other symmetrically, became kind of a simple rule that I followed most of the time. So I'm not really thinking about the shape, you know, per se, as I am thinking about how to organize the space of the format. And in this case, I was literally thinking about a folding, an infolding, like if I were to lift up those triangles and kind of set them on top of each other. So, I mean, I'm always sort of playing in my mind with an activation, how to activate the space, and then how the shapes themselves might move. But of course, painting is an incredibly static thing. It's just sitting there. So
you're generally starting with a square and you're generally dividing it in half, like horizontally?
Horizontally. Well, the series, as is, so there, is a group of small rectangles, actually. They're not squares, but they're 10 by 12 inches, and they were sort of this, almost like a sketchbook for me in the studio. They were panels I'd had sort of laying around, and I decided to employ this very simple rule: divide that rectangle in half, and And then deploy these six-sided shapes, and that really just becomes a stage, really, to employ color and sort of have that battle between color and design or color and drawing play out on that surface. And I mean, that's another way to look at these, is what is that relationship between color and form? Sometimes color will absolutely deny the form or negate the form, and other times the form is supporting the color. So those are some of the kinds of things I'm thinking very formally as I'm working.
You said you sort of use this series, the small ones, as a way to clean your brushes. Was that a metaphor?
Not a metaphor. It's quite literal. But that's a starting point. So I might have a loaded brush with a color that I wanted to unload some of that color, so it's not as full when it went onto the one painting that I was mm-hmm. working on. So these would be sitting there around, and I would just make a stroke or two to kind of lighten the load of the brush and then move the brush on.
But these panels are the same medium as the big piece you're working on.
That's birch correct. Panels? Everything is on birch panel, but these small panels do not have a heavy ground, meaning for the larger ones, I have a more complicated process of adhering paper, magazine paper usually, and then a mixture of house paint with plaster in it, and then sometimes the flash goes down. So there's this buildup that creates a very absorbent surface. These small ones are really just the oil and flash and graphite right on the wood panel. So they're more immediate. When you see them in person, they're in a way fresher. They're fresh.
But did you know you were doing them as you did them? Like the first time you cleaned your brush on a spare panel, did you know, this is going to hang in a gallery?
No, honestly, no. I mean, there's so much going on in the studio that you never know. I mean, there comes a time when you have to start making those decisions. And I knew early in the summer that these were becoming important, sort of an important anchor for the bigger pieces that I was beginning to work on. I was referring back to the small ones. And they became a really good vehicle for me to just be able to refer to and then learn something from. But when I first started doing them, they'd been hanging around in the studio for a couple of years.
Oh, okay. Just like horizontal?
You weren't putting them away? Actually, that's a really good point, because the thing about them being that small is I could hold them in my hand and just make some moves on them. And the fact that at that point, they weren't anything important made me more free to mm-hmm. do just what I was going to do.
How much work was it to knock them into shape for Liz Leach Gallery?
Well, part of that work is the decision. Is this going somewhere? Is this going to be something? Some of them are more labored than others. I would say in general, there's a range in the work. When you see the exhibition, there's some panels, for example, the three paintings that are 30 by 39, Narcissus for DJ, Upend. I've had those panels for over 2 years, and there have been multiple images and attempts to make an image work. So when you have a deadline and you know the exhibition deadline is coming, there's these sets of decisions. You either arrive at it or it fails. And if it fails, you don't let it out the door. So for every one of these that get out the door, there's a few more that don't mm-hmm. make it.
And when you say multiple images, you mean you're overpainting?
Overpainting and sanding. A lot of taking an electric mm-hmm. orbital sander and just like taking it back down to that layer of paper that I mentioned, or sometimes back down to the wood and then building it back up.
Are you taking it all off, or are you leaving, you know,
well, it's impossible to get it completely all off.
But you're happy with those little mm-hmm. Revealing old layers.
Yes. I used to have an issue with that, and I've sort of embraced it for this exhibition. I used to try to be as one shot as possible. There's a body of work that I set that goal. But I've embraced it for this exhibition. There's something, again, about that idea of the topography being a space of discovery and maybe even sort of a calming effect as you kind of range your eyes as over the surface, and staying again on that surface, the present. Trying to really make that analogy that if you can stay on that surface and it's engaging enough, that keeps you in the moment. Mm-hmm. So, but when you see the actual paintings, the objects, I think it's very obvious the range of immediacy and also labor that's gone into them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I always go see the work. This is the first time I've ever done a show where I only saw the work digitally, and yeah. we're talking like tiny little JPEGs on yeah. a tiny screen yeah. on a computer. So that's very bad.
But you're admitting that, yeah.
Somebody listening on the radio, you know, what are they going to see if right. they go in? Are they going to want to touch these things?
They might. I think they're very related to the body. I mean, you mentioned in the very beginning that they're about, many of them are about a size that you could wrap your arms around. And it was important for me to make work that somehow did relate to the body. I was talking about the small ones. I would actually hold in my hand and work on them in a horizontal position. And then the largest ones that are 65 by 62 inches. Those I really had to wrestle with and sort of negotiate with by myself. They were a little bit bigger than I could get my arms around. And so there's a lot of physicality in the work that was really important for me, for myself, for my practice. But I think that that comes through for the viewer. And I think the two largest ones, there's the ability to enter into the space.
What are they called?
The first one we were talking about is As Invisible as Possible Unfolds in a Twinkle. Mm-hmm. And then the second one that's that large, that really dominates the space, is called The Inexperienced Miracle Worker. And that actually, that title comes from a line in the Nabokov novel where he's talking about, in the same passage that I'm describing as a sort of metaphor for painting, he says something about, if you're not able to stay on that surface, there's this thin, transparent surface of reality that covers everything, and if you're not reality that covers able to stay on that surface in the now, you drop through into the sort of, you drop through into this malaise of nostalgia as an inexperienced miracle worker. And so he's sort of, it's sort of, in a way, the inexperienced miracle worker is the one that can't maintain that relationship mm-hmm. to the surface. And actually that image...
Is that you in this work? Is it you, the
maybe.
Painter? Or the viewer? Should the viewer feel bad about themselves?
Well, I hope they don't feel too bad about themselves, but maybe it's a warning, a cautionary tale. Yeah.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Michelle Ross. Her show, Trust Falls and Transparent Things, runs September the 3rd through September the 26th at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl District. Michelle's a professor and head of the Department of Drawing and Painting at the Oregon College of Art and Craft. I have a lot of fun with your titles. Abstraction can be pretty daunting to someone who doesn't know art mm-hmm. history. You use titles to lure in the average person?
Absolutely. I use whatever I have at my disposal. I've always been a big reader. I love poetry. There's all sorts of literature and poetry and theory, and I have a huge library in my studio. So that those
are... Oh, you actually read books in the space where you do your messy
yes.
painting?
Yes.
How do you keep them clean?
I have a clean space. I have a little loft that's a clean space where a lot of the books are, and there's a desk up there. But, you know, so much of the labor of painting is the opposite of action. in that you need to have time to assess and reflect on what you've just done, especially if you're not working observationally. I mean, I have a huge respect for artists and students that I teach that the sort of fundamentals and the ethic of looking at something and reproducing that and that observational practice, which in some ways, when I've practiced it, is much more meditative because you really need to stay in that hand-eye feedback loop. And it's very intense to work that way. Working abstractly, it's definitely more theoretical in the sense that you have this set of possibilities and you test them, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't work. Labor is often the assessment and knowing when to stop and knowing when to wait. So one of my strategies is to have the painting in the periphery while I'm doing something else. And then if I can read, I'm reading. So I'm doing something else. I'm reading or I'm cleaning brushes or I'm just, the answer will come to you in the periphery.
Mm-hmm. I had R.V. Smith in here a few months ago who had a show of figurative painting at Mark Woolley. And he said he spends more time looking at what he's just painted than he does actually painting.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that. It's that sort of observation of your own work being so valuable.
Yeah. That's actually one of the hardest things to get students to realize, because they're under deadlines. We're all under deadlines. And so there's this idea that you have to just keep going. But I would just reiterate that labor is oftentimes the not doing or the stopping. Mm-hmm. It takes an effort to stop.
As a professor at a art school, you're seeing a lot of young people coming in with fresh minds, yep, and but new techniques or new expectations. What do you see and what are the things you urgently try and change?
It's very interesting when they get to OCAC, because usually students that come to OCAC already have a desire to work in analog ways, meaning with materials. And yet every single one of them has a smartphone or a laptop or a tablet. The biggest shift that I've seen or that I've had to adapt to is the idea that the source material, the inspiration, the things that are exciting to the students, the younger students, are usually coming to them through these devices.
Like what?
Anything that they could Google, any sort of popular culture, cartoons, music. I mean, I have a lot of students that I just met, a group of new students that were just comparing notes about all the cartoons that they watch. And of course, I have to quickly do my research and get online and figure out what they're looking at. But a lot of CGI, a lot of computer generated imagery that doesn't have its genesis in the world of materiality. Mm-hmm. So my challenge, our challenge up there, is to figure out how to sort of bridge that gap. And we work really intensively with materials. I teach painting students about pigments and mediums and surfaces and grounds and how to build the surfaces that they want to paint on, or how to get found objects that they might want to paint on ready. So there's a real intensive engagement with material, and at the same time a recognition that what their culture is coming through all of this technology.
So you don't just mean when they need to get an image of a robin, that they'll Google it and start drawing the robin.
I do mean that. That is what they do.
Yeah.
But then it's my job to show them all the other ways they might find a robin. And
because I have heard that people tend to take the top one, and then you get all these people who drew the same image from Google Image without looking very far.
Yeah, but it's also teaching critical thinking skills, how to assess what might be the best Googled robin image, or is it how do you transform that image? How do you see what sort of copyright issues there might be with that particular robin or any others? What might happen if you walk down the street to the Hoyt Arboretum and take a walk in the woods and see some actual birds? It's just that kind of discussion that ends up happening. And also just the effort to get them to print stuff out and not work from the screen.
Oh, what's the difference?
Well, if they're printing something out, then they can take that printout and manipulate it in ways that they might not be inclined to do if they're just looking on the screen. They can cut it up. They can draw on top of it. They can add collage material on top of it. So I always see my job as to encourage and sometimes require them to transform the source material in
right.
some way.
You think maybe people have become a bit too passive about the screen?
It's got its dangers. I think it's an incredible tool because we can see so much more from our limited vantage point by going into the screen. But I think there needs to be a real critical approach to how you're using the information that you're getting from it.
What do you think about this idea that drawing has lost its roots as just observational and it's become this thing, kind of extended doodling? Is that a thing?
I love it when anyone wants to pick up an actual implement and use it to make any kind of image or even handwriting. I think that's maybe we're getting less able to do that. But we have a really intensive foundations drawing curriculum at OCAC. So I'm immersed in the ethic that we're teaching people how to work observationally. And most of the students love it. The younger ones sometimes have a hard time sitting still for as long as it sometimes takes. But once they start to see the results of that feedback loop between their hand and their eye and the object and the space around the object, it's pretty magical. Many students come in with an already developed style that they've adapted from everything that they've seen in popular culture, cartoons or graphic novels or just their own inventiveness. Sometimes it's a matter of loosening their grip on that, assuring them that it won't disappear, getting them to do the looking, and then in the end, seeing how it comes back together.
How do you feel about a bunch of your 18-year-olds being dropped down in the Liz Leach Gallery on opening night, looking at your work?
I teach on Wednesday night an intermediate painting class. So they're going to all come down there with me because I have to be down. I can't be in two places at once. They oftentimes have questions about abstraction. And there's always the question of whether what I'm doing is relevant to them. But it'll be very interesting to see what kind of response I get. I think at the very least, they see that I'm practicing and that I'm working hard and that I have a vital studio practice, and it may not be their sort of style or imagery that they're interested in. But I don't know. I'm just sort of speculating right now.
This show at Liz Leach in September is not all you got going on. Just quickly, what else is happening in your life?
I'm very excited to be part of a group exhibition. It's a painting exhibition that Blake Schell is curating at the Art Gym in January 2016, coming right up.
And Merrillhurst University.
Then I'm taking a group of OCAC alum and curating a project up at Soil Gallery in Seattle in April. And then I have a solo show at the Art Gym in October of 16. So very busy year ahead, which I'm super excited about.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Michelle Ross. Her show Trust Falls and Transparent Things is on from September the 3rd through September the 26th at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl. Michelle's a professor and head of the Department of Drawing and Painting at OCAC. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Who is Gil Scott-Heron as part of the We Real Cool Jazz Series at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, September 17th at 7 p.m. Who is Gil Scott-Heron is a portrait seen through the eyes of those who love Gil, his friends, his family, and the musicians he played with. All attending the theatrical screenings receive a download of Scott-Heron's last record, Nothing New. Again, that's Who is Gil Scott-Heron? Thursday, September 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Rockets and moonshots.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Other September 11th, film screening and discussion about the lasting impacts of the U.S.-funded military coup in Chile on September 11th, 1973. The event will take place on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. This film screening will include two 30-minute documentaries that focus on Mapuche land reclamation and language revitalization, as well as a discussion with the filmmaker about the specific laws that have been used to target the indigenous Mapuche people since the dictatorship began in 1973. Again, that's the Other September 11th on Friday, September 11th at 7 p.m. at Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lights, Camera, Action, making video easy on Wednesday, September 2nd, 6 p.m. at Portland Community Media. Lights, Camera, Action, a collaboration between PDX Tech for Good and Portland Community Media, this seminar will show you how to make high-quality video for outreach and fundraising using the cutting-edge technology available at Portland Community Media. Again, that's Lights, Camera, Action, making video easy on Wednesday, September 2nd, 6 p.m. at Portland Community Media. 2766 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.